A short 5 foot 2 inch lady stood in the pulpit preaching. It was a Sabbath morning, and as was customary when Ellen White spoke, everyone was listening. She was wearing her loose fitting black sack dress. I know that most of you have seen a picture of her in later life as she dressed, and the Sabbath was no exception. She was wearing this, and on this particular day, she was talking about the matchless love of Jesus for each one of us. And all of a sudden, right in the middle of her sermon, she stopped. And it seemed as if she had momentarily forgotten that the audience was out in front of her, and she looked up as if she were looking right into the very face of Jesus. And she said, "Oh Jesus, how I love you, how I love you, how I love you." Ellen White's oldest granddaughter, who was just a girl at that time and was there that Sabbath and heard that and told me the story, said that a hush came over the audience. It seemed as if heaven was very near. Ella, that was the name of the granddaughter, also told me that of all of her recollections of her grandmother, that was her favorite. For 70 years, Ellen White brought messages of reproof, instruction, correction to this church. And as most of you know, those of you who are members of the church, based on the text in Revelation 12, 17, 19, 10, and others, we consider the gift of prophecy to be one of the identifying marks of the remnant church. And so this morning, I thought it would be helpful, as we've been talking about various pioneers, that we spend one day talking about Ellen White. And before we do, I want to show you a few overheads, just, we'll see how these turn out, just to show you some pictures of the family. You may have seen all these, and maybe you haven't, but Ken Ford is back here helping me. This is a picture of Ellen White's father, Robert Harmon. You know, he was a hat maker. There's only one known picture of the father, and none of the mother that we know of. We've tried to contact various descendants of other members of the Harmon family, and so far we have not turned up one of unit. But this is a picture of Ellen's father, Robert Harmon Sr. There were 8 children in the family. Well, the top one didn't turn out very well. But we don't have pictures of all of the children. There's a brother, John Harmon, that we don't have a picture of. Apparently all the family pictures were destroyed in a fire in the house. At least that's what we've been told by descendants. And we don't have a picture of Robert Harmon Sr. But that picture there, which isn't turning out very well, that's Ellen and her older sister, Caroline Clow. And then if we want to go up, I'm not going to say much about these because I want to get... The light picture on the left is Sarah Harmon Belden. You know Sarah's son, Frank Belden. I don't know if you knew that Frank Belden, F.E. Belden, the hymn writer, was a nephew of Ellen White. And then on the right there is Mary Harmon Foss. These are all older sisters of Ellen Harmon White. Mary died in 1912. She was the last living, except for Ellen White. So those were the last two sisters that were living, Mary and Ellen. Ellen died in 1915. Next picture is Ellen White and her twin sister. Probably some of you at least, or maybe most of you knew that Ellen was a twin. Standing is Ellen White. Seated is her twin sister, Elizabeth. Ellen called her Lizzie. Lizzie Bangs. She married Reuben Bangs. And Lizzie, unfortunately, had no interest in religion. And I heard Arthur White, Ellen White's grandson, say one time that of all the members of her family, the only one that Ellen had no hope of seeing in heaven was her own twin sister. The others were all Christians. They were not all Sabbath keepers. Some accepted the Sabbath. Not all of her brothers and sisters did. But they were all professing Christians, apparently, except for Lizzie. So Ellen wrote to her sister. She would go visit her sister. I read one letter that she wrote to her. Just said, "Lizzie, can't you just acknowledge that Jesus loves you?" And apparently Lizzie had no interest in religion and wouldn't even go that far. So it was a sad situation. That's a picture of Ellen and her twin sister. All right, we'll go to the next one. I just kind of threw this one in. I'm not sure that makes that much difference to you. This is William F. Farrington. And you remember the Harmon family were disfellowshipped from the Methodist Church in September of 1843. He was the pastor at the time they were disfellowshipped. William F. Farrington, the pastor of the Chestnut Street Methodist Church in Portland, Maine. where they were disfellowshipped
for becoming Millerites.
Next one is just a copy of the marriage certificate, which the original is at the White Estate, the General Conference. James and Ellen White were married by a Justice of the Peace on August 30, 1846, and then shortly after started keeping the Sabbath. A picture of James White will be the next one. This is not actually a photograph, it's an engraving of James White. You may or may not have seen this engraving, it's been reprinted sometimes, but it's kind of interesting. In 1877, a book came out in Michigan called The Eminent and Self-Made Michigan of the State of Eminent and Self-Made Men of the State of Michigan. And James White has a section in there, and he had this engraving done to go in to illustrate his section of biographical sketches in this book, The Eminent and Self-Made Men of the State of Michigan. He was so pleased with this engraving that he urged Ellen, who was out going to camp meetings at the time, and he was working at the office. He wrote to her and encouraged her to have her engraving done, and hinted that if hers turned out half as well as his, why, she didn't like hers also. So we have a picture of her engraving. She had one done the next year in 1878, and so I have a copy of that engraving. You've seen this one too, I think. It's been reprinted many times. But the story behind it, of James having his done and liking it so well, he encouraged his wife to have hers done. And then one last picture, and then we'll get into some insights from the life of Ellen White. Picture of the family. I should have had one other picture done, and I didn't think to give it to Ken. I had it another place in my notebook. But this is Ellen White's oldest son, Henry White, who died at the age of 16 and in 1863. This picture that we have here was taken in 1864. Now, we don't know this to be a fact, but we just kind of assume that since son number four, who was John Herbert and died at 3 months of age in 1860, he'd passed away. And then son number one, Henry, had died at the age of 16 in pneumonia in 1863, that the family may have decided before we lose someone else, we better have a family picture taken. So that we can't prove, but it's interesting. The first family picture was taken shortly after Henry died. But you have Ellen White, and then you have son number three, which is Willie White. You'll hear a story about him a little later. And then James White, and then Edson White on the far right. He started the work among the blacks in the South. And so that's the family after they had lost their oldest and their youngest son. So I just wanted to show you a few pictures. So for those of you who may not be quite so familiar with the family, as some of the names get mentioned, why, you will at least know who we're talking about. I don't know if you've ever stopped to think about it, but Ellen was shy. You may not realize that as you hear some of the stories about her, things that God called upon her to do, but she was basically a very shy person. For those of you who have studied her life, you know that as a young girl at a Methodist prayer meeting, she was so shy that she couldn't even pray out loud as she attended the prayer meetings, and it took her a great deal of courage to get her nerve up to be able to pray out loud. I don't think she ever got over that basic sense of shyness. When I was in college, more years ago now than I want to admit, but I was going to school out in California, and there were a number of people alive who still had personal first-hand recollections of Ellen White. And I took the opportunity of getting the privilege, I guess would be a better way of putting it, of talking with several of these people. One of them that I talked with was Mrs. Alma McKibben, who was in her 90s at the time, and she had written our first church school textbook. And she was on the faculty of Pacific Union College in the early days, and she told me about a time when Ellen White had come from her home at Elmshaven up the hill to the new college, which was established on the hill in 1909. Now, the administrators of the school knew that Ellen White was getting along in years, and they knew that she wouldn't live forever, and so they invited her up to speak to the students in chapel as often as she was willing to come, so that the students would have the opportunity of hearing Mrs. White. Mrs. McKibben told me on this particular occasion, Ellen White had come up. She had spoken for just a few minutes. It was one of her last, if not her last, visits to the college. And then after the chapel service, they took Mrs. White over to the dining room. Now, one thing that Ellen White enjoyed with her meals was a bowl of greens. These could be salad greens or mustard greens dandelion greens, any kind of greens. She didn't care. She just liked greens. And for whatever reason, they weren't serving any greens that day. Now, Ellen White had a lady who the last 30 or so years of her life appointed herself, and with Ellen White's acquiescence, of course, but appointed herself as Ellen White's nurse traveling companion and guardian. Her name was Sarah McInturfer. Apparently, Sarah had a deep voice, because as people would quote Sarah to me when they would be telling stories, they always went down a notch when they would quote Sarah. So apparently she had a deep voice. Well, anyway, Sarah was along this day, and she spied the situation and noticed that there were no greens. And knowing that Mother, as she called her, she wasn't related to her, but knowing that Mother liked greens, Sarah went back into the kitchen area, and before long she came bearing triumphantly this bowl of greens and handed it to Ellen White. Now, one of the problems that Ellen White had was every place she went, people were always watching and looking. And Mrs. McKibben told me on this particular day, there was no exception. Everyone was looking, you know, to see what is she eating. Is she mixing this with that? You know, all these things we get hung up on sometimes. Is she living up to the council, in other words? And so everybody's looking and watching. And here comes now Miss McInturfer out bearing this bowl of greens while everybody in the cafeteria is staring and looking and trying to see what Sister White's doing. And good church school teacher that Mrs. McKibben was, she noticed. She said, you know, Ellen White, Sister White, blushed. She didn't want all that fuss being made over her in front of all those people. And she said, well, Sarah, I could have gotten along without my greens at least one time. And Sarah said, well, Mother, there's no need to deprive yourself. And with that, the greens were delivered to Sister White. And I tell you that because as we hear some of the stories that... or read some of the stories that of things that God called Mrs. White to do. Remember, it was never easy. This was not something that she coveted, the position. It was not something that she wanted. In fact, those of you who have read the biography or life sketches, the 6-volume biography by Arthur White, you remember that when the call came, she asked God to take it away. She did not want it. This was not something that she wanted. Now, there were some advantages to being the Lord's messenger. She got to converse with angels. She saw Christ on more than one occasion in vision. In fact, I was talking with Ellen White's oldest granddaughter, Ella Robinson, that I mentioned earlier. She said that one night the members of the family were awakened by a shout, "They come! They come! Holy, harmless, and undefiled!" And then there was total silence. That's all they heard in the middle of the night, but it woke them up. Now, Ellen White's habit after she had a vision in the middle of the night was to get up and to write it out. And so naturally, after they'd been awakened from this vision when Ellen White called out, why, the members of the family wondered, what in the world had God shown her in vision that caused her to shout out, they come, holy, harmless, and undefiled. And the next morning, when they went to find out what she had written, there in her handwriting was the draft for the resurrection portion of the Great Controversy. And as she had seen those graves wrenched open at the second coming of Christ, she had shouted out in a vision of a night, they come, holy, harmless, and undefiled. So, yes, there were some advantages to being the Lord's messenger. Another one that Ellen White's youngest granddaughter, Grace Jock, who you may have noticed in the review, just died about 3 months or so ago, the last living grandchild of Ellen White. But she told me that one time Elder Daniels came to the Elms Haven home of Ellen White. And you remember he was president of the General Conference at that time. And Elder Daniels came to visit Mrs. White, and she was sitting in her writing room, which was on the second floor, the east end of the house. And as Elder Daniels came in the door of the room, Ellen White looked up and greeted him and said, "Oh, Elder Daniels, it's good to see you. Did you see the angel?" And I don't care if he was president of the General Conference, he was taken back a little, and he said no. And she said, "Well, my angel messenger was here conversing with me and passed you there in the hall as you came down the hall to my room." So as I say, being the Lord's messenger had a few advantages that we don't have, but there were also some distinct disadvantages. For instance, Ellen White had absolutely no control at all over when she would be given a vision. She could not think to herself in the morning, you know, "I'm going to get James off to the office, and then I'll get the boys off to school, and little Willie, I've got chores for him, and then I want to get the wash done, and then I'll have to worry about the noon meal, and I think, Lord, about 3:00 this afternoon would be a good time if you want to give me a vision." Didn't work that way. In fact, some of you may have heard of another lady by the name of Margaret Rowan. Margaret Rowan claimed after Ellen White's death that she was Ellen White's successor, that God had appointed her to be Ellen White's successor.
And so she was living in Los Angeles, and the men in the Southern California Conference didn't know quite what to do about it, so of course they sent to the General Conference. And a committee was formed, and the committee came out to Los Angeles to have an interview with Margaret Rowan. And one of the clues that they had that she was not genuine was after they had met all morning with Margaret Rowan and her husband, they were just ready to break up to go their separate ways for lunch, and then they were going to get together in the afternoon, or at least the husband suggested they get together again in the afternoon, and he said, "I think Margaret is feeling a vision coming on, and if you'd come back this afternoon, she'll have a vision for you." Well, it never worked that way. God controlled when the visions were given to Ellen White. She couldn't, as I say, just decide that about 3 o'clock this afternoon would be a good time. Now, as an illustration, let me tell you a story that some of you have heard, but maybe it'll be new for some of the rest of you. James and Ellen White were traveling. They were always traveling, so that is not unusual. It's 1858, and what James White used to do was he would put on the back, other ministers did this too, but they would put in the back page of the review a listing of their itinerary. Now, they did their best to keep that itinerary. If they said that on such and such a date they would be at such and such a place, they would try their best to be there, but, sorry about that. They would try their best to be there, but they didn't always make it. You know, all the ministers would do this because we didn't have any assigned pastors back then. None of our churches in the early days had pastors. We didn't have enough ministers. So they were all out traveling and doing evangelism and that kind of thing. And so, as I say, when they were traveling between churches, they'd put their itinerary. However, Jane Andrews quipped one time that if there's one thing that God doesn't know, it's where James White really is going to be next Sabbath. He'd try to get there, but he didn't always make it. Well, anyway, they had put a notice that they were going to be in Lovett's Grove. James and Ellen White were going to be in Lovett's Grove, Ohio, the weekend of March 13, 14, 1858. And so they came, they held meetings on Sabbath the 13th, and then one of the members of that little church had died. This was another disadvantage of the pioneers. Often, because the ministers were so scattered and were so few, when one of our believers died, they were not buried by an Adventist, Sabbath-keeping Adventist pastor because there was none available. On this particular occasion, since the man had just died and James White was there, they asked if he would stay over and have the funeral on Sunday afternoon. Of course, he agreed, and so he had the service in the little schoolroom there where they were meeting in Lovett's Grove. And then after he had had the service, Ellen White stood up. She wanted to offer just a few words of condolence to the members of that bereaved family and that grieving congregation. And as she stood and just started to speak, she went into vision. Now, we do not have an exact eyewitness account of that vision that includes this, but often when she went into a public vision, she would shout out, "Glory to God." From the accounts we have, she would usually repeat that three times. Glory to God, glory to God. And it sounded like her voice was getting farther away. Now, as I say, I don't know if that happened at Lovett's Grove because we don't have that in the account of that particular vision. But we do know that she went into vision. Everything stopped. That was the end of the funeral. And I tell you this because I'm sure that if Ellen White had had her way, she would not have chosen to disrupt a funeral. You know, those are solemn, somber occasions. That's not when she would want to have a vision and disrupt this whole funeral. Everything stopped. The casket's there. Everything is put on hold for 2 hours as Ellen White is in vision. And everybody, of course, wanted to know, what is it that God is showing Ellen White that's so important that he would disrupt a funeral to give her this vision? Today, we call it the Great Controversy Vision. When she came out of the vision, she told them briefly what she had been shown. Now, from God's perspective, what better place to give that vision than right there in front of the open casket? If you want to unmask Satan, you want to show what he's been all about, you want to talk about the results of sin, what better setting to give the vision in than there at that funeral? So I can see why God chose to do it there. But we're talking for a few minutes today about Ellen White and trying to look at things from her perspective, and I'm certain that she wouldn't have chosen to have had that vision at that particular setting. However, after she had told them briefly about what she had been shown, she and her husband, James, got on the cars, that's the old-fashioned term for the train, they got on the train and they went up to Jackson, Michigan. And there they were going to spend a little time with some friends, other believers, by the name of Dan Palmer and his family. And while she was there in the Palmer home, Ellen White suffered a stroke of paralysis. she almost died. In fact, it was so bad, James began to pray for her. The Palmers prayed. Word was sent out to other members of the little congregation there in Jackson to come and pray. And they prayed, and finally Ellen White rallied enough so they could get her back on the train and take her the few miles from Jackson on to Battle Creek, where the Whites were living at that time. And there she was put to bed, very weak. She wanted to write out the vision that she had been shown in Lovett's Grove, but she was too weak to even hold a pen and write. Finally, she got strong enough so she could write one page, and then she was so worn out from that experience that she had to rest for 3 days, and she wrote another page. Finally, she got to where she could write several pages in a day, and eventually, several months later, the manuscript for the first edition of Great Controversy was completed. In September of 1858, this little book of 219 pages, you can buy a facsimile of it at the ABC, Spiritual Gifts, Volume 1, it's called, but it's also the first edition of Great Controversy. Now, after Ellen White had completed the manuscript for the book, she had a subsequent vision, another vision. And in this later vision, she was shown that the stroke of paralysis that she had suffered there in Jackson on her way home from Lovett's Grove after having the vision was Satan trying to kill her. Talk about complications. Not only did she not have any control over when a vision would be given her, but this particular vision almost cost Ellen White her life. Satan does not want us reading Great Controversy. He does not want us to know what he's up to, and as I say, he almost killed Ellen White. So there were some disadvantages. Let's think of some others. Most of what you read in the testimonies are reproof, instruction, encouragement, that kind of thing when she's writing to individuals. You don't find very much flattery and praise in the testimonies when she's writing to individuals. Now, there's a lot of encouragement, but she's not usually telling people how wonderful they are, how good they are, how great they look, how nice their hairstyle is, their clothes, all that kind of thing. Now, we tend to do that of each, oh, how nice you look today, and on, you know. But this was another disadvantage, because some people took offense at the fact that many of the messages that God gave Ellen White to pass on to them were not flattering. Well, that's because some of the things in their lives were not too flattering. They just didn't want to admit that. But this, again, was one of the disadvantages. We tend to flatter and praise each other. God tends to try to correct and bring us into line with the pattern that He has for our lives. So that was a bit of a disadvantage, because much of her work was giving reproof, correction, and instruction. Another disadvantage that she had was she had, well, I shouldn't say, I was going to say she had no control. Sometimes she did have control over when she would deliver a message, but sometimes she did not. Now, on occasion, she did. She might be coming to a camp meeting like this, and she had been given a message for a minister or a conference administrator or maybe one of the members of the church that would be present. And on these occasions, she would call the person to her tent or the room where she was staying, and she would have the message written out that God had given her for the person. And often she would have another person there. If it was the minister, she might have the conference president present, or her son, Elder W.C. White, who was a minister, someone present, and she would read the message. On those occasions, she obviously had control over when she would deliver the message. We have stories, accounts of times when she would hold a message for a year or longer because the time was not right. God had given her a specific message for an individual, but she would hold it. We could tell stories of those. But I'm thinking of a time when she had absolutely no control over when she was to deliver a message. Elder D.E. Reebok tells the story of one occasion when God gave a specific message for Ellen White. For whatever reason, God did not choose to tell Ellen White who this man was that she was to deliver the message to. He did not choose, apparently, to show her this man's face. She did not see his face in the vision. All she heard was his voice. And she was told, when you hear that voice, deliver the following message. And she did not happen to recognize the voice, so she was not sure who the person was that she was to deliver the message to. All she knew was she had a specific task when she heard the voice. Sometime later, she and her husband, James, were coming on to a campground. They got settled in their tent, And then they came over to the main tent where a meeting was in progress. And as the two of them walked toward that main tent, I think Ellen White's heart must have sunk a little in her chest because she heard the voice. And if you hear a voice coming from a meeting that's in progress, hopefully there's only one voice you hear. Well, she seated her husband James in the back, and then this little 5'2" lady started walking down the center aisle. You don't have to use much imagination to picture what was going on there. As people noticed the servant of God coming down that center aisle, you can almost feel electricity when you read the story. People whispering to each other, "There's Esther White. I wonder what she's doing. I wonder what's going to happen now." And she kept right on walking, right down to where the man, the voice, was speaking. And she stopped right below the pulpit. And she looked up and she said, "Brother, I have been shown that you have no right standing in that pulpit preaching to this congregation." Have any of you ever thought you'd like to be the Lord's messenger? Any volunteers wanting to say, "Lord, I'm the one"? Now, I don't know what kind of an ending he had planned for his sermon. Probably he had a good one planned, but needless to say, he didn't use it. That was the end of the sermon. That's not the end of the message, though. She went right on before he left the pulpit. She said, "Brother, I have been shown that you have on this campground a woman that thinks she's your wife, and you have children here who call you father." And then she said, "I have been shown," and she named another state, "you have a woman there that thinks she's your wife, and you have children there who call you father. You have no right standing in that pulpit preaching to this congregation." Exit. That was the end of him. He left. But we're thinking for a minute. I mean, all kinds of thoughts go through your mind, I know. What if she'd been wrong? She knew she wasn't wrong. She'd had years of experience trusting the heavenly messenger. She knew without a shadow of a doubt that if God had given her the message, it was correct, so she wasn't worried about a lawsuit. But we're thinking for a minute about Ellen White. She was a human. God was working through human clay, a human vessel, to bring these messages to the church. And I think as a human, Ellen White must have breathed just a little prayer of thanksgiving to God, because she has a congregation now she has to deal with. When a man stood up, we're back with the story now. That was my speculation about Ellen as a human, must have breathed this prayer of thanksgiving. But a man stood up in the congregation and he said, "I'm Elder so-and-so's brother, and everything that Sister White just said is true." He said, "Several years ago, my brother came and confided in me that he was leading a double life." He said, "As far as I know, I'm the only person that my brother ever shared that information with." As I say, I think Ellen White must have breathed a little word of thanksgiving to God for the confirmation. But it was not easy being the Lord's messenger. In 1880, she was at a camp meeting in Vermont, and she wrote to her son, this is from letter 42, 1880, about another experience there. She said, "I had some very bad jobs to perform." In other words, she had some testimony she had to give. "I took Brother Bean and wife and talked to them very plain. They did not rise up against it. I cried myself. Could not help it." Ellen White knew what it was to receive messages, because some of those messages came for changes she needed to make in her own life. Ellen White knew what it was from personal experience in her own family to deliver messages, because some of those messages were to her husband, James White, who was not particularly a docile, laid-back individual. I don't know how many of you men would like to be married to a prophet. You know, right now, sometimes our wives will give us this honey-do list, honey-do this, honey-do that, honey-do the other thing. What if you had with it, "Honey, I have been shown by God that you should do this. And honey, I have been shown by God that you should do that." You know, I've never read one place where James White said, "Oh no, not another one of these messages." Sometimes he said, "Oh no, I don't know how we can accomplish it, how we can do it." And it might take him several months before he stepped out in faith and did it. But they knew. James and Ellen White knew what it was. James and Ellen White knew what it was to have visions, messages cut across their plans. And here she is dealing with this couple at the Vermont camp meeting. delivering some, what she calls herself, very bad jobs to perform. She begins to cry with this couple. When you're reading the testimonies, and you come across something in the testimonies that you think could have been said a little nicer, maybe it was a little too stiff, and we don't always know the circumstances. Sometimes God was dealing with some very extreme circumstances, and so the messages had to be very straight to try to get through to these people. But I would urge you, when you read something and your reaction is, I don't know why it wasn't said just a little softer, remember that often Ellen White's pen was dipped in tears as she was writing. We have letters where she would write to individuals and she'd say, the tears are falling from my face as I write this to you. One of the beautiful things about her letters that you'll find if you ever have an opportunity to read her unpublished letters, even in cases where she is holding, where she is really moving in on a person and encouraging them in very, very strong ways to change, at the end she always holds out courage, encouragement, hope. One place she's writing to a young person and she said, if I thought your case was hopeless, my pen would not be tracing these lines. There's always that hope, always that encouragement in the writings of Ellen White. But it was not always easy for her. In fact, in 1874, letter 2, I want to read you something that she wrote to Elder J.N. Loughborough. I have felt for years that if I could have my choice and please God as well, I would rather die than have a vision. For every vision places me under great responsibility to bear testimonies of reproof and warning, which has ever been against my feelings, causing me affliction of soul that is unexpressible. Never, she said, have I coveted my position, and yet I dare not resist the Spirit of God and seek an easier position. No, it was not easy to be the Lord's messenger. In fact, as I've had the privilege of talking to several of Ellen White's grandchildren, one of them told me on one occasion that once in a while, not very often, but once in a while, Ellen White would come from her bedroom in the morning and she would ask them in the family, did you hear the angel choir sing last night? And they would say, no, Grandma, we didn't hear the angels singing last night. But as the family talked about it among themselves when those kind of experiences happened, they came to the conclusion that occasionally, when the burden of being the Lord's messenger would become so hard for Ellen White to bear, God would send the angel choir to sing to her at night, to lift just momentarily the burden that he knew she was bearing. Ellen White never claimed to be perfect. I know some Adventists have put her way up here on a pedestal, and Ellen White would deplore that if she was alive, because she was a fallible human being. As you know from her writing, she says there is no one infallible except for God. She tried to be a Christian example like anyone else, but she certainly did not set herself up above anyone else. So she would not have wanted that extreme that some Adventists have put her on, where they've almost sainted her. Neither could she understand the other extreme in our Adventist church today, in our church today, and that is those who totally disregard the messages that God has given. She would not be able to understand that extreme in the church either. It's a good thing that she never claimed to be perfect, because she wasn't. She made mistakes like anyone else. Her family wasn't perfect. They made mistakes. Just because you were the prophet's husband or children, you certainly didn't have any claim on sainthood. A little story that Arthur White tells will illustrate just how human the White family really was. Willie White, you saw a picture of him, son number 3, born in 1854. Willie White was attending public school in Battle Creek. We didn't have a church school at the time Willie was going, and for some reason, this particular year, he did not like his teacher. And so, he and a classmate, one night after school, got back into the classroom some way, and Willie, he's written no books. He's written some articles, but he's written no books. But he tried his hand that particular day at writing poetry. And this is the little poem that he wrote on the blackboard there in the public school in Battle Creek. The devil flew east and west, north and south, and caught up Miss Jones in his mouth. But when he saw he had a fool, he dropped her here to teach our school. if you ever thought the white family was above the rest of us, perish that thought. Now, after he had written this little literary masterpiece there on the blackboard, he and his friend took off. The next morning, when the teacher arrived, she was a bit better school teacher than Willie gave her credit for, because she recognized his handwriting. So she knew exactly who had written this piece there on the blackboard, but she left it. So there it was, when all the students came in, here was Willie's poem on the blackboard. They all got seated. Now remember, she knew who had written it, but she said, would the boy or the girl, probably in the formal language of that time, she probably said, would the young man or the young lady who wrote this please identify himself or herself? And some things have not changed in the last 140 or so years. Nobody said a word. So she went over to little Willie's desk, and in the formal language of the time, she said, Master White, I know you wrote this. I recognize your handwriting. I want you to take it back. Or, I want you to apologize. Now listen to what Arthur White said his father's response was. I can't take it back. Now that might have been strong enough, he should have stopped right there, but he didn't. He kept right on going. He said, I can't take it back. My parents have taught me always to tell the truth. He really did not like this teacher, as you can see. I said to Elder White, what happened to your father? He says, I never heard that part of the story. But he says, knowing a little bit about Grandpa White's tendencies, he said, I would assume that there was probably a session out in the woodshed after there had been a session with the teacher to try to explain young Master White and his attitude. Anyway, as I say, the White family was no different. Well, maybe it was different. Hopefully none of your children have done this. But it was not that different than we are. They were very human people. Ellen White had to struggle, and she prayed for her own soul and her children's soul. You remember son number two, Edson, that we showed the picture of and started the work in the South? That was in the 1890s. Edson was in his 40s. What have you read about Edson in his 20s or 30s? You haven't read anything, and you won't read anything, because he was doing nothing worth writing about. In fact, he was, for all practical purposes, out of the church. He was very talented in many ways, but in other ways he had a lot of eccentricities, enough so that he bothered his father, James, who on one occasion said, I don't want to even be in the same state with that kid. Edson had so irritated his father. You can picture Ellen torn between her husband, son number two, trying to keep these kids together, the family together, trying to keep peace between son number three, Willie, and Edson. There was tension there. And Ellen was praying for this talented son that some way he would be converted and give his heart to the Lord. And yet he had no interest at all. He was more interested in making money and anything else. And she's down in Australia. He'd given his heart to the Lord. She was thrilled. Years of praying for this son. And then we know what a work he did. But he certainly wasn't doing it in his 20s and 30s. He waited till his 40s. And there in Battle Creek, in the Review, we're told, in the Review and Herald Publishing House, Edson came across a defective copy of a testimony that they had just printed from Ellen White, Our Duty to the Colored People. I don't know when it says defective, if it was torn, if ink was on, I don't know. God can work through mysterious ways. Edson picked that up, and he caught a glimpse of something he could do. I can go start a work for them. I can do something. And his dream grew, and he wrote and told his mother about that. And of course, she was thrilled at what he wanted to do. Now, she had no assurance how her family would turn out. I mentioned her twin sister. She had no assurance even of her own salvation beyond what you and I have, of falling on the mercies of Jesus, asking for forgiveness just like you and I do. Ellen White was a very human person that God was working through. She was also a very sensible, moderate individual. Now, I know some Adventists have a very extreme, dogmatic view of Ellen White. They could probably summarize all of their understanding of the spirit of prophecy on about one page. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing, don't. That's it. I asked one time, two of Ellen White's grandchildren, I was visiting with Arthur White and Grace White Jacques, the same time the two of them were sitting and we were talking. And I asked them about this, the view that some people have, don't. I said, did you grow up in a family where there were a lot of don'ts? Because they lived very near their grandmother, some of the time with their grandmother, other times very near. And they said, no, we had no don'ts in our family. I said, what? I was a little surprised myself. They said, the reason we had no don'ts is because we had so many do's. We were always doing things. We were doing things as a family. So in the early morning before breakfast, we were out working in the garden. We had stuff all day long. We were doing things as a family. And when we played together. When we worked together. We didn't have time for don'ts because we had so many do's. Oh, I said, well, that put a different light on it. But some Adventists, you'll have this narrow, restricted view that we can't do anything, that we have to look gruff and sour. Ellen White had, by the way, no use for what she calls sour piety. She did not think that a long-faced Christian properly represented our Adventist religion. That would surprise some Adventists that I've met who think it's a sin to smile, or at least they act like they think that. If you think you have found something extreme, keep reading, because the testimonies, if you read everything that we have been given on a particular topic, you'll find that when you put it all together, it is very sensible and moderate. Now, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes God did have to deal with an extreme situation, and you will sometimes find extreme counsel on a particular given topic, but that's not all that's been written on that topic. Keep looking, and you'll find that the plan that God has given this church, on whatever topic, makes sense. It's middle of the road. Let me just give you a couple of examples if you don't believe me. One time, Ellen White was preaching in Healdsburg. And on this particular Sabbath, in the spring, they had all the windows closed. They were afraid they were going to catch their death of pneumonia if they had any fresh air. Now, you know, if you've read anything about Ellen White's health message at all, that one thing she advocates, and God had shown her, is that we should have plenty of fresh air. And as I say, this Sabbath, everything was buttoned down tight on that church because they were just positive they were going to catch their death of pneumonia. Now, if Ellen White was the extreme, domineering, dogmatic individual that some people paint her as being, why, she would have started her sermon that Sabbath something like this. What's wrong with you folks, anyway? Haven't any of you read the counsel that God has been pleased to give this church? Why do you have all the windows closed in here? No, she didn't say a word. She just stood up and began to preach her message. After a little while, she paused and she said, you know, it seems to me like it's a little close in here. I wonder if the deacons would mind opening the windows on this side of the church. And so the deacons got up and opened the windows on that side of the Healdsburg church. And then Ellen White resumed preaching. After a little while, she paused again. She said, you know, it seems to me like it's still a little close in here. I wonder if the deacons would mind opening the windows on this side of the church. By the time she sat down, the person that was there who told me this story said, by the time Sister White sat down, she had every door and every window in that church standing wide open, but she hadn't mentioned fresh air at all. Oh, she said, we all got the point. But she hadn't mentioned it at all. Let me give you another example. You know, if you have read the counsels that God has given this church through Ellen White, that she has been shown that for most, now I underline, I capitalize, I italicize, I bold the word most. I did not say all. Ellen White did not say all. God did not tell her all. That for most of us, we would be better off if we ate two meals a day instead of three. Ellen White, the last 30 or so years of her life, tried to practice a two-meal-a-day plan. All right, put yourself back into that time. You see a notice or you get word some way that Ellen White is looking for a new secretary. And you think to yourself, and she had male and female secretaries both through the years at different times, so we can all think about this story because she employed both. So you think to yourself, what a privilege, what an honor it would be to work for Ellen White and help prepare her manuscripts for publication. I think I'll interview for the job. No, wait a minute, I'm not so sure I want that. I'd have to live in her house. And she's on that two-meal-a-day plan, and I really like to eat three meals, and I think that would be a handicap. You know, you wouldn't have to worry about it at all. Ellen White did not even impose upon the people living in her house the daily schedule that she was keeping. Breakfast would be at about 7. Lunch was at about 1, 7:30, something like that. Lunch was at about 1, and then there was no formal meal served in the evening. But because Ellen White knew that members of her staff, some did want to eat in the evening, and that often she had company and they would want an evening meal, even though no formal meal was served in the evening, Ellen White's cook was told to set out in the pantry fruit, fresh or canned, depending on the season, bread, something people could make sandwich from, maybe some cottage cheese, something like that, something light that people could have an evening. Ellen White did not even impose upon her own staff the lifestyle that she was practicing based on what she understood was to be the best that she could be doing in terms of living up to the counsel God had given. I wish some of our members today could
could adopt the same kind of policy when it comes to dealing, especially with new members, who we hear horror stories at the White Estate of how they've been so turned off because some dear saint somewhere has decided to impose their own view, their own lifestyle, on a brand new member who hasn't grown that far. What a tragedy. Because people get turned off, and they may for years miss the blessing of studying the Spirit of Prophecy Councils because of just some unthoughtful word that some member has offered to them.
Well, here I've only got about 5-6 minutes, and I haven't gotten through halfway through this talk. Well, Ellen White had a sense of humor. Now, I mentioned earlier, some people think it's a sin to laugh or smile. No, Ellen White was not silly or giggly or anything like that. I don't mean to imply that. But when something funny happened, Ellen White could see the funny side of it. And several incidents, I'll tell a couple of them, are in this little book, Laughter and Tears of the Pioneers, that I mentioned earlier, that I understand they're going to get some today. They're supposed to be arriving at the ABC today, if any of you are interested. These little human interest anecdotes. But there were several experiences that we could record. I recall, I don't have time to do very many now, but one time Ellen White, this was about 1914, so right towards the end of her life, Ellen White received a package from Japan. She was living there at Elmshaven, and here came this package from Japan. And, you know, it probably had all these funny stamps. I mean, funny to her, not to the Japanese, obviously, but funny-looking stamps to her and a little cancellation and all that. And Ellen White was very human, and naturally, when the package arrived, she wanted to open it and find out what was in it. And so it was opened up, and here was this nice hug-me-tight. Now, a hug-me-tight has been described. I wasn't sure what it was, but sort of like a vest. So here was this hug-me-tight that one of the missionaries' wives had made for Ellen White over there in Japan. She wanted to do something nice. She'd made this handmade hug-me-tight, mailed it across the ocean, and now it's arrived at Elmshaven. Well, first thing Ellen White wanted to do, of course, was to try it on. Unfortunately, when she tried it on, it only came about two-thirds or three-quarters of the way around. In other words, it wasn't big enough. It didn't fit. And with a chuckle, Ellen White asked her secretary to please write to this missionary's wife, Sister Davini, and to thank her for her thoughtfulness. And then she said, and make certain you add, there's a great deal more to Sister White than some people think. I've thought about that in other terms in recent years. Another time, she was preaching. On this particular day, as she was preaching, she noticed that the people out in the audience were kind of nudging each other and whispering and pointing a little, and she couldn't imagine what she'd said or done. And, you know, if you've ever been up in front, why, you know, is my tie crooked or what if something like this happens? Well, not sure. She looked herself over. Everything looked fine. She couldn't imagine what was going on. When all of a sudden, she happened to glance over her shoulder, and there was her full-grown son, Willie White, a minister, our poet friend now, grown up, a minister sound asleep. Now she knew why people were pointing and laughing and having a little fun, because Mom had put son to sleep with her preaching. She said, you know, when Willie was a baby, she knew she had to say something now that she knew what it was. She said, you know, when Willie was a baby, I had a little cradle made. And I would put it here by the pulpit, and as I was preaching, I could rock Willie. It had a little thing that stuck out on it, so she could put her foot on it, and she could rock him as she was preaching. And that way she kept him quiet while she was speaking. And she said, you know, so when he was a baby, he learned to sleep during my sermons, and he's never outgrown the habit. And everybody had a good laugh, and I suppose he woke up. People love to be around Ellen White. It was very clear to me as I had the privilege of talking to people that the view that they have of Ellen White, a warm, loving, generous individual, is much different than the view that some of her critics try to pawn off on us today. Ellen White was very concerned about people. I have been told that at the great 1888 General Conference, when Elders Jones and Wagner were preaching Righteousness by Faith, and her soul was just drinking it in, thrilled, sitting there in the congregation at that General Conference session, listening. What else was she doing? She was knitting socks, so I've been told. Why? Because we had missionaries in Europe who would soon be facing a very long, cold winter. And while her heart could be taking thrill to be responding to the message of Righteousness by Faith, she could be doing something practical also for these missionaries, and she'd be sending off little packages to missionaries. Later, when she was living at Elmshaven, they dried tons of fruit. She had 2,000 prune trees at Elmshaven. She'd go out and buy up whole orchards of pears and peaches. She had a regular drying business going on there for, well, part of it was some of these dues for her grandchildren. They had work. But also part of it was she would send free packages of fruit
to missionaries, free packages of fruit to the South, to Oakwood College that was beginning to be established in the had been established in the 1890s and was now beginning to grow. She sent these love packages to people. As she would drive around during the day, when she got older, of course, she couldn't do as much exercise. When she was young, she liked to do a lot of physical exercise, and so she did yard work and all that. As she was older, she was not able to do that as much anymore, but she still liked to go for buggy rides. And as she would be riding along, either over in Australia or after she came back to the United States in 1900, around her home there at Elmshaven, she would often mention to those in the buggy with her as she would be passing a house, "I wonder if the people in that house know anything about Jesus." And if she saw them out, she usually had some produce from her garden or from her orchard. She would have some fruit, and she'd have a tract, and she would stop and talk with the people. And for years after she moved away from Australia, and for years after her death at Elmshaven, we're told that the neighbors recalled her as the little lady dressed in black who came around in her buggy and talked to them so lovingly about Jesus. What a legacy to leave behind. No wonder people enjoyed being around Ellen White. They would come and stay sometimes for weeks. Why not? The food was good. The fellowship was wonderful. Why not? People would come and visit Ellen White. Now, as I close, since my time is up, I want to close by showing you something that most of you probably have never seen. Now, if you've not seen an Ellen White letter, I have one of those along too. But usually when people from the White Estate come, why, they have long letters of Ellen White with her handwriting, and so you've seen them. But many of you have never seen an envelope from Ellen White. So as I close, I just want to ask you this question. If you'd been alive back then, and you had called for your mail at the post office, and you'd received an envelope like this, with Ellen White's return address up here, and your name down here, would you have had the nerve to open it? Now, if I wasn't out of time, I could tell you several stories of people who did not. One man waited 28 years before he finally opened his letter. That's an interesting story. We don't have time to tell. Another young man was a young minister. He received a letter like this, and he was nervous. And he said to the Lord, "Lord, help me to have the nerve to open it, and then help me to have the nerve to do whatever I'm advised I should do." And then with that prayer, he opened the letter. I remember he's just a young minister. And what was the counsel? Preach shorter sermons. He was preaching about an hour and a half, and he was thinking about making them longer, because he thought the longer he got, the more he could hit more people in the congregation. You know, if he said a lot more, somebody else would get something out of the sermon. She said, "Preach shorter sermons." What did he do in his life? Much of this man's life, he turned out to be a hospital or sanitarium chaplain. Sick people could not take long messages. What beautiful advice to this young man, but yet how practical. So here I am. Now, of course, you don't have to worry about it, do you? Because Ellen White died in 1915. So you're not going to go to the mailbox, and you're not going to find an envelope like this with your name on it. Except they're the testimonies for the what? The church. Who's that? That's us. So I guess our names are still on the envelope, aren't they? So the question I'd leave with you this morning is, do we have the nerve to open this precious counsel that God has given this church? Now remember, when you're reading, not everything was intended for you. Some people have that problem. They find themselves in every single testimony. That's not true. But the Holy Spirit, if you pray for guidance, will help you find just those messages that will help you in your Christian experience to grow, to be more Christ-like, and to be more ready to meet Jesus when He comes. After all, that's the whole purpose of the testimonies for the church, to prepare a people to be ready to meet God. And so I leave you with that challenge. Do we have the nerve to open and read so that we can become the men and women, the boys and girls that God wants us to be?
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.